Welcome to the Legally Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, Rob Hanna. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Joshua Brumley. Joshua is the CEO of Brumley Law Firm. He graduated from the University of Washington, completed his MBA at Jacksonville University, and attended Florida Custodial School of Law. Joshua has experience as an off-counsel, equity partner, and managing partner. Joshua is a member of the board of directors at the Pierce County Center for Dialogue and Resolution, where he gives back to the community by volunteering. Joshua is passionate about empowering individuals from marginalized groups in society. Joshua's work has been recognized as he was selected to Rising Stars between 2020 and 2023. So a very big warm welcome, Joshua.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. And before we dive into all your amazing projects, experiences, and everything you're getting up to in and around the legal community, we do have an icebreaker question here on the Legally Speaking Podcast, which is, on the scale of 1 to 10, 10 being very real, what would you rate the hit TV series Suits in terms of its reality of the law on the scale of 1 to 10 if you've seen it?
I have seen it. I think when I was a 1L in law school, first year in law school, I remember one of the early episodes of the show talking about contracts requiring offer acceptance and consideration. And I was like, whoa, this is exactly what I'm learning right now. And after that, literally nothing else about the show was real, and I completely stopped watching it, and I don't love the show.
So with that, we'll assume a very low score and move swiftly on to talk about the realities of the law and indeed your tremendous career. So obviously I touched on very briefly in the introduction, but would you mind telling our listeners a little bit more about that background and career journey to date?
Sure. Yeah. I've always been sort of a business-minded person. My undergrad was in business management, and I remember being on the plane to fly to Florida Coastal School of Law, and when I was on the flight, I remember thinking, this might be the stupidest thing I've ever done. I know nothing about being a lawyer, but I'm going to go for it. And during law school, I realized very quickly that I have a skill set that helped me to be successful comparatively to other people who have maybe more of an adverse reaction to public speaking. My background prior to law school, I liked to play live music, and I booked a lot of bands and played in some bands. And so that same feeling of being on stage in a live music event, it was the same feeling I got from public speaking and doing debates and things like that. So it was very easy for me to transition into that public speaking role that other people apparently have just a real serious fear and aversion to. And so that helped me a bit because I just didn't have that natural reaction.
Yeah, I love that you talk about your journey from sort of being in bands, and because we've had lots of attorneys and lawyers come on the show over the years, and you know, trial lawyers, they talk about the importance of being an artist in some respects in terms of trying to put your case across and having that confidence and everything that you refer to. So if that's sort of built within you and that comes naturally to you, that's great. But where did, I guess, the original spark for law specifically come from? What inspired you to really want to go into the law?
I think there's many different things I attribute to that that journey. I don't think it was one thing specifically. I think it was, you know, everything happens for a reason, and my life kind of led down a path of many stairs. And one of the easier things to discuss, I think, is that when I was doing live music, I was, you know, 18, 19 years old, 20 years old, and then I started booking my own shows around 21 years old. And the city that I lived in, you know, they had all these requirements. And so I would book a live show at a local American Legion Hall or something like that. And it'd be a one-off thing. And I said, oh, well, maybe I should just rent a space that I have my name on a lease and do these things repeatedly, like open a business, open a live music venue. And so I signed a lease on just, you know, the dungiest, grossest place I could afford that, you know, as a 21 year old, I'm hopeful that enough people come to these shows that I can make the rent. You know, it was something like $1,000 a month. And I was like, this is so crazy. I don't know how I'm going to make $1,000. And, And the city came in the first month and said, hey, this is not zoned properly. It's not a public occupancy space. You can't have live music events here. And I was like, what does that even mean? I don't know what you're talking about. And then I signed a lease on a second space, and the city, the fire marshal came down again and said, no, man, you can't do this here. We just told you this, shut it down. And they shut down my venue a second time. And it was like in newspapers that I was shut down, and nothing bad happened. There was no fire or anything like that. They just were like, stop signing leases on places you're not allowed to do this kind of work in, kid. And so I ended up going down to the city engineer building and asking, like, hey, what do I need to know? What do I need to understand to get this done properly? And they showed me all these building codes and laws and stuff that I just didn't really understand. And I had to dig into it, and I had to have a lot of conversations with the city code and city enforcement people down at City Hall. And I was just this young kid. I at that point hadn't even finished my undergrad career, so basically no college under my belt. And here I am learning, and then eventually arguing politely with the city officials, saying, no, these rules shouldn't apply. These are the ones that should apply, and here's why. And it got to the point where either they were so sick of hearing from me, or they agreed with me that they agreed with me. So eventually I got a live music space opened that is still open to this day. It's called Real Art Tacoma. It's a licensed nonprofit agency in the city of Tacoma, Washington. And I'm not involved with it anymore. The law firm career kind of took precedence and I bowed out, but the people that are running it now are still very dedicated to youth and art and music. And I think it's an incredibly important thing and led me down this path to, wow, if I could do that, what else could I do to help people?
Absolutely. And that you are doing. And I guess 2015 was a big year for you because you founded your own law firm. So, you know, what were your motivations behind setting up your own firm?
Well, I went away for law school. I moved from Seattle, Washington, which is the northwest of the United States, all the way down to Florida for law school, which is the southeast, basically as far from home as I could be within the continental United States. So when I moved down there, I didn't know if I was going to stay, if I was going to come home. And my legal network during law school was really in Florida. And so after moving back home, I didn't have a lot of those connections that I had built in Florida here at home. And I was applying for jobs, but didn't have experience because I was a brand new, just minted attorney with a bar number that had never been in court. And so people were just, you know, that's not what they're looking for. When they want to hire a new associate, they want someone with like 3 years of experience. And that's what they call a new associate. So I had to start volunteering for some local nonprofits, and during my time volunteering for Tacoma Pro Bono, which is a legal aid organization dedicated to family law, I met some attorneys who were looking for people to help them in a public defense role that was paid, but very, very part-time. And I met a family law attorney who was interested in working with me. So I did some contract work for both of them. Got some courtroom experience, and then opened my own firm to start really just taking cases on my own from the experience I got from them.
Yeah, well, good for you. And I love that sort of ambition. The firm specializes in personal injury. So could you explain what personal injury services you offer?
Yeah, so in Washington or the United States, specialization is a term of art that has to have some sort of connotation with like a certification or something. So our focus is personal injury, but we're not a specialized firm. I'm not aware of any that are quote unquote specialized, but all that being said, it doesn't mean we are better or worse than any other personal injury firm. I think we are, but there's no documentation that says that. the focus of personal injury is really just, we say car crash, call Josh. And while we can help with, you know, slip and fall, premises liability type cases, or dog bite cases, we really pride ourselves in exceeding expectations in recoveries on car accident cases. And so that's our goal with marketing is to find and assist people who have been injured in a motor vehicle accident.
Yeah, and I guess that's going to be a super interesting space looking forward with autonomous vehicles. And, you know, there's a lot to sort of think about there in terms of where does that ultimate liability, and maybe that's a whole new podcast in itself in terms of we'll have to get you back on to talk about that and, you know, what potentially lies ahead. But, you know, your firm, you have experienced legal representation. Always listen, always communicate, have the right approach and have a compassionate care. So would you mind just going into a little bit more detail about those areas for our listeners?
Sure, sure. So I think a lot of, from a lawyer point of view, I think a lot of lawyers have a hard time getting a client to sign on the dotted line when they do an intake. I think a part of the problem with that process is people don't have that sales gene. And as a business person prior to my engagement in being a lawyer, I think I've always had that sales gene. As a young man, I was selling candy to the neighborhood kids. You know, that's just something that's been innate in me, like my public speaking. But for people who don't have that as a skill set and have to build that as a skill set, I think that, you know, you spend a ton of money on leads, you finally get the phone to ring. And then if that person doesn't sign up, there's this incredible pressure on the next phone call to get them to sign up. And that feeling of desperation comes across to people. And so confidence is really key. And when we say we're good at listening, I think it's incredibly important when we're doing an intake. And I coach all my staff this way. Just get them to tell their story. If a client calls you and says, I need to sign up about, I had a car accident, I had a slip and fall, I had a dog bite. Just say, oh my gosh, tell me what happened. Because the more time you're on the phone with this person, the more that you're connecting with this person, the easier it's going to be for them to feel like they want to sign. And then you don't have the pressure, the burden, the sales part of it really breathing down your neck. When people give their story, you know, spend 30 minutes on a phone call telling an intake person, yeah, this is my background. This is where I work. This is my history of prior car accidents or prior injuries. This is my, you know, insurance information. This is my health insurance information. This is the at-fault party's information. All of these details are incredibly important when you're doing an intake. And if you jump right to the end and say, yeah, here's the contract, please sign, that's pushy. And people don't know, first and foremost, that contingency fee means you don't pay us any money unless we recover money for you. And when they hear that, then there's no reason that they shouldn't sign up with an attorney, but there might still be a reason that they don't like you and your firm. And so understanding that in this space, most, if not all attorneys, as far as I'm aware of in Washington State, all attorneys charge the exact same price. So the pricing model is not something that they're going to be able to shop around for. And you can encourage them to call another firm and say, hey, this is the industry standard. 33 1/3% of the recovery is what everyone's going to charge you. So really the only difference that you're seeing, it's not about price. You're not shopping around for price. You're shopping around for service. And so what's that service level look like? And that's the next component. So always be listening, do a good job on these intakes, understand what the client's needs are, what they need from you to feel better throughout this process, what their level of communication requirement's going to be. Some people require a lot. Some people say, just handle it and tell me what I need to do. And everyone's different. So understanding what those needs are, and then servicing those needs individually, giving client-focused service to that person, incredibly important. And you're only able to do that if you understand the person you're talking to. So just give them the opportunity to talk, put them on a pedestal, lift them up, understand if they have children that were in the car, how are their children doing? That's an incredible, stressful thing. Understand if they're working, are they able to get to work? Do they need a rental car immediately? What is their boss telling them about how soon they need to be back at work? You know, rich people don't usually hire a personal injury attorney for a non-catastrophic accident. Low income and middle class people do. And those are the people who need to make it back to work immediately. And so understanding that a lot of their point of view is not going to be based on their personal physical health, but about their rent and their ability to provide for their families. And understanding that point of view when you're doing that intake is incredibly important, because they might say, I'm fine. But really what they're saying is, I'm more concerned about how I'm going to get to work to provide for my family. And if you can give them that peace of mind and then encourage them to get the medical care that they're going to need, that is going to be paid for by the at-fault party's insurance, there's no reason for them not to do that. But I think that a lot of people have a hard time describing that process and helping people feel empowered in that process to do what they need to do to maximize their settlement value or their claim value. And education is just really key in that intake process.
Yeah, and I have to say, it's an absolute masterclass for anyone in terms involved, in legal, in sales, in consulting, in business. You know, I loved, you know, going back to your first question, you know, there was an empathy statement. There was an open question. Tell me about, you know, you're getting them to open up. You're meeting them with that human connection. And then, you know, I always talk about the three principles in terms of getting people to buy. It's time, quality, or cost. So if cost and the price isn't the issue, it's going to be the quality of the service in terms of, okay, so how are you really meeting them as that human individual? And then, you know, potentially could be a time sensitive matter as well. So absolute masterclass there in terms of needs, wants, understanding your clients and being there and making yourself stand out as a professional, and just, you know, the line of questioning. So absolutely, just rewind that question, folks, listen to that again, take some nuggets of wisdom away, because that was brilliant. Okay, so let's talk about what people may be unfamiliar with. We've got listeners all around the world, not just in the US, not just in the UK, but, you know, those who might be unfamiliar with what stages of making a personal injury claim looks like, a case looks like in Western Washington. Can you give us a bit of a flavor of that?
Sure. So a car accident happens. We encourage our clients to always call the police. Having a statement, a police report that's written by a third party, like a police officer, that can help determine liability when liability is not clear. You know, rear end accidents, it's usually almost always clearly the car behind who is at fault for following too closely or X, Y, or Z other issues. But when it's not a rear end collision, liability is not always cut and dry as we'd like it to be. And so taking photos, getting a police report, having evidence that can bolster our position for our clients is something that we can't do after the accident has already occurred. So making sure the clients, if anyone in the United States is listening, I'm sure this advice is very similar anywhere, but photos of the surrounding area, photos of both cars' property damage that can help with reconstruction. You know, if it's a sideswipe accident, one car might be over a lane, and that car who's over the lane is probably going to be the car that's found at fault. So we want photos of how the cars came to rest. We want photos of skid marks. We want photos of the surrounding businesses, the streets, and there might be camera footage that could be accessible that we only find from searching nearby those businesses and stuff. So understanding that photography and documentation is really key. A lot of times people say, well, we didn't want to do a police report. The other guy had, you know, he had his kids in the car. He had to get to work at X, Y, Z. But then later on, they find out that the other party said that they were driving away. They drove a block away, and then they called the police and said that the other party, my client, was at fault. So protect yourself. Don't let people leave the scene without calling the police. If the police don't come, you can still file your own police report online. We encourage that. It's less persuasive when it's written by yourself, but at least it's a document that we can say, look, this accident happened. Here's proof this accident happened, and this is the date and time and our client's point of view about the accident. So an attorney can help you understand how to do that if the police didn't come. And then we open the claims process with the at-fault party's insurance. That process can take, you know, weeks, it can take months, it can take years. It just depends on the level of injury and the treatment that's involved. Every case is really unique, and you know, you hear that all the time, but it's really true. The level of injuries determine the time frame
for the most part, that someone's going to be treating. And the level of insurance also comes into play. If, for example, in Washington State, our minimum insurance policy for liability is $25,000 per person. So if someone hits you and you have broken bones and you're taking in a helicopter to the hospital, the insurance company is going to be chomping at the bit to just send you that $25,000 insurance policy and close this case, because they know that your medical bills are going to far exceed what their liability is unless they mess something up and open themselves up to judgment in excess of that policy. So they're going to just say, here's the $25,000. But if it's a $1 million policy, that might not be the case. Contrarily, if it's a $25,000 policy, but it's relatively minor body damage to the car, the insurance company might really dispute paying any of your medical bills. And so that might make the process take longer. So understanding what, how much pie or how deep the pockets are from the person who hit you, that really comes into play for how long your case might take. If it's a small pie with serious injuries, it's going to be over quickly. But if it's a big pie with serious injuries, a big pie with less serious injuries, or a small pie with less serious injuries, it just might take months, years, you know, however long it takes. It also depends on the insurance adjuster. Every person that's involved with these cases has a different history of experience and negotiation style. Some of them are very aggressive. Some of them are very friendly. And, you know, my negotiation style, I think you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. That's the saying. And so I try to come in friendly until there's a reason not to. And then I just file the lawsuit and negotiate with the defense attorney. And so we're not shy about filing lawsuits over here, but it's a conversation that we have on a case-by-case basis. And it's not a requirement to file a lawsuit to negotiate and resolve a claim for personal injury.
No, I love that. And again, thank you for being so thorough on how it all sort of works. So I want to talk about something else that I know is very important to you is about sort of helping everyone as much as possible. And what I'm referring to is those in perhaps marginalized communities or who do not speak English natively, who are especially perhaps likely to receive unfair treatment or not understand their actual rights. So how do you go about explaining to clients their rights, and how do you ensure they have a clear understanding of the legal process?
Well, I try really hard to be active in the local community here in the city of Kent that I'm sitting at right now. This is an incredibly diverse city comparatively with the rest of Western Washington. We have many, many different people who English is their second language, and a lot of organizations, nonprofit agencies in the area that are dedicated to one diverse group or another. And so I network with those groups to put on Know Your Rights events. And they will always provide translator services from English to whatever language. For example, we're very close with the Iraqi Association. We do Know Your Rights events there on a regular basis. And the people in the Iraqi organization are all bilingual so that they can help the individuals who come to the organization to engage in American culture and society and understand how laws work and what processes are for obtaining car insurance, or, you know, things that we kind of take for granted where we just pick up a phone and call. You know, people don't really understand car insurance, actually, you know, who are born and raised in the United States. So imagine going to another country and trying to understand in a different language how UIM and PIP and liability and all the different coverage. I could put on clinics about that for just English speakers. So the idea of trying to understand those concepts in other countries is just something that I couldn't imagine, going to Iraq and trying to understand how their insurance works from people who don't speak English. But having these folks here who need help understanding what the requirements are so that they're not driving without insurance and they want to do things the right way, but they just don't know where to start. So putting these clinics on has been really, really beneficial. And we have brochures that are translated in a lot of different languages so that when we put on these events, people can kind of take away some of the Know Your Rights stuff. When we do these Know Your Rights clinics, we also engage with other legal professionals or insurance professionals to kind of put on like a panel so that the information that they're getting isn't just from me about specific car accident related items. But I also encourage maybe a friend who does immigration to come with, or a friend who sells insurance to come with, so that people can have that robust network kind of built for legal resources or insurance resources that they might not have known that they needed access to. And now they're right here in front of you. So I try to put on those panels with a diverse group of people. So it's not just me talking about car accidents, but I also have a history of doing other areas of law. So criminal defense, I think, is something that a lot of people are worried about when they have immigration consequences. And so they don't want to call the police, even if they're the victim of a car accident, because they're worried about deportation, removal proceedings, that kind of stuff. And I always encourage everyone in Washington state — every state is very different about their immigration policies, but at least in Washington state, no police officer is going to cart you away and call ICE and get you removed. They're going to write up the police report how the accident happened, and your immigration status is not part of any of the car accident proceedings. So I don't think that that's something to be worried about, but I understand that that's something that people are consistently worried about in these underserved communities. And so they don't call the police, and then they don't understand that the other party did, and then they don't understand that they're being sued and they don't have insurance. And so a lot of things can come into play just from hoping that no police will be called. So protect yourself, protect your rights. We say protect your neck. Get the police involved and get a report done. Protect yourself.
And that's very true, isn't it? That, you know, you have to take the steps to protect yourselves. You can't just rely on hoping things are going to go in the right direction, because unfortunately, if you do, it could probably not end up in your favor. And it's interesting you use the Iraqi example. You know, I'm actually half Iraqi myself, so that kind of really resonated with me in terms of when you're giving those examples.
Today's episode is brought to you by Clio Payments, the ultimate solutions for law firms looking to streamline their billing and payments. Clio Payments, available in the UK, has updated its pricing for pay-by-bank transfers, allowing you to accept these transfers for free. Yes, that's right, zero fees on bank transfers. And here's the cherry on top. Until May 31st, 2024, Clio is offering new customers an incredible 90 days of free card processing on card payments. With Clio Payments, which is included in Clio Managed Subscriptions, you can handle all your billing, payments, and collections seamlessly right within the Clio platform. No more switching between systems, no more headaches, just pure efficiency. Record your time, generate and send bills, accept payments, and automate reminders and reconcile payments all in one place. Even after 90 days, you'll continue to enjoy free pay-by-bank transfers. As for card payments, they'll be charged at standard rates. Don't miss out on this incredible offer to save money and gain more time for what truly matters. Visit clio.com/UK/payments today to learn more and start simplifying your law firm billing and payments process. That's clio.com, clio.com/UK/payments. Offer ends 31st of May 2024. Terms and conditions apply. Now back to the show.
So I want to talk a bit more about how you manage it all, because alongside the work with your firm, you also, I understand, litigate four other firms, I believe. So would you mind telling us about the work you do with other firms, and how does that work? Because I'm sure a lot of people listening are going to be like, a CEO of a firm, he's doing this, and this. How does this other stuff work?
Well, I guess the first most important thing is having a really robust, dependable staff that can help run things when I'm away. Because if I'm in court, if I'm in trial, if I'm in a deposition, and something's exploding, I need staff that's dependable, that would do things how I would do them and understand that if they need to get a hold of me, then don't take action and get a hold of me. But I have a really wonderful staff that's taken years to cultivate into the leaders that we have in the firm and the dependable staff that we have in the firm. And that's something that's not an easy thing to achieve. So first and foremost, I couldn't do any of these things without the staff that I have. That being said, I think a lot of lawyers who are kind of dipping their toe into this industry, personal injury, motor vehicle accidents specifically, they see the idea of it being incredibly lucrative and how many people are trying to find cases in this area. And so they'll sign up cases, but not really know how to do the case and think, I'll just learn as I go. That's incredibly dangerous in any area of law to learn as you go. If this is someone you care about, you don't want to learn on their case. And if it's someone you don't care about, you probably should. So I try to encourage the lawyers in my network to send their car accident cases to my firm. And if they want to litigate with me or have me litigate these cases, I will. And so a lot of these attorneys that I work with, just they have experience doing other areas of law. And if the negotiations before filing a lawsuit break down where they can't get the amount of money that the client deserves or that they value the case at, then they send the case to me to actually do the litigation portion, because I'm just set up to do this kind of litigation in a way that they aren't. And so we work with a number of firms doing that. If there are anyone listening who has a car accident case in Washington State and isn't happy with their attorney, or they're an attorney who just is maybe out of their element, you know, doesn't understand what Winter's fees are or Hamilton letter is or any of the important things that are associated with obtaining policy limits and why that's important, then probably you shouldn't be doing this, and you should focus on one solid type of law and just get really great at that. And that's what we're trying to do here at Brumley Law Firm. And I think we do a great job of it.
Yeah, and I think I've said this a few times on the show. One of my favorite sort of Bruce Lee quotes of all time is something along the lines of, you know, I don't fear the man who's practiced 10,000 kicks. I fear the man who's practiced one kick 10,000 times. And really that kick, that one particular kick, that specialization is really what, you know, people go to. And so I think you gave a really good example of that. And you're kind of touching on it there before, but just again, because just to get people to be aware, and, you know, we want to help and educate people as much as possible between, you know, let's be frank, predatory insurance company practices and attorneys who do not take time to sort of really communicate the process. What are the potential dangers or challenges clients could face?
Well, clients don't know what a good value for their claim is. And that's really clear to me. The problem is, if you have a bad attorney or an inexperienced attorney or an attorney who's really just like, I have to settle this case because I got to keep the lights on and I need the money, even the attorney might not know that they're doing it. They might not want to do it, and they just don't know what they don't know. And so I really went into this in a small amount in the beginning, but understanding how big the pie is, what that policy limit is, really like a basic first step of understanding how much you can get. And if you're settling a claim for $22,000 and it's a $25,000 policy and the client had uninsured motorist coverage, then you don't get access to the secondary pie, the UIM coverage. You don't get access to a whole other value of case because you settled the claim for less than the policy limit. And if you didn't know that it was a $25,000 policy, you don't know that you're $3,000 away from unlocking a whole other dessert. Understanding that policy limit is the most important thing. And I see it so much that other law firms who maybe aren't as familiar with this process are just not getting this information. And there's just no way to evaluate a case if you don't know that threshold issue.
I think it's details matter, don't they? And I think understanding, you know, needing those details or understanding what it means to have that particular information is super, super important. Because like you say, you don't know what you don't know. And so that's the value that they're bringing there. And, you know, people always say, you know, again, a lawyer friend of mine said, you know, people don't ask, you know, hire attorneys to answer questions. They hire attorneys because they know the right questions to ask in the first place, right? And that's to your point about the policy limit and everything else that's going, right? So I think that's really where the wisdom and what you're getting in terms of that value. One thing that is still needs work in progress, and that's for sure, and something that we advocate for on the show, and our sponsor Clio also does, and I'm sure you do, is access to justice. How are you encouraging access to justice in Western Washington? What steps do you believe still need to be taken to improve the access to justice in your state?
Well, a common consideration in Washington is, what does a jury look like for a client? So understanding that diverse juries are beneficial and non-diverse juries can damage people. So that's a focus that there's a ton of research on. And I think when you put it in plain terms like that, everyone can agree that if you have a client who looks or sounds completely different than what the jury is made up of, they might not be as empathetic as a jury who does look and sound like the person that you're representing. And so keeping that in mind when you're doing voir dire and when you're preparing for a trial and all of that, understanding that language barriers are really difficult for people to overcome. I only speak one language. I can't imagine being bilingual. I can't imagine going through a court process or a deposition in a different language. Even if your client is considerably articulate in English, if English is their second language for a deposition, please always, always, always request that the person deposing them provide an interpreter. It's paid for by the person deposing them. There's absolutely no downside to it. And it helps them to understand the questions better that might be asked in a way to trip them up. And if they're asked in their second language, it's more likely it's going to trip them up. So get a translator, get an interpreter for any legal proceedings that your client is going to be asked questions in a recorded on the record type way. There's so much that comes to mind. Doing these clinics, doing these Know Your Rights events, incredibly important. I think a lot of attorneys are interested in donating money. I'm a vocal proponent that money's not enough, and money is not what these organizations need to survive. They need people. They need time dedicated to the people that they serve. And so volunteering for organizations like Tacoma Pro Bono or these Know Your Rights events to put them on, to take initiative and create a way for people to learn about their legal rights outside of what you do on a normal 9-to-5 basis is just super important. And I know that that's a big ask. And, you know, my staff is like I said, an incredibly important part of why I'm able to do those things. But I don't think it's impossible. And the attorneys who, you know, want to get off work at 5 p.m. every day and go home and do their home life, that's okay. But those are not the attorneys that are going to be seen as community leaders and seen as people that get referrals. And so if you're worried about when your next case is coming through the door, maybe you should ask yourself what you're doing for the community to engage.
Yeah, and it's a good point, isn't it? Because ultimately, you know, community is everything when you strip it back. And I think the more that you can do for others and, you know, as a result of that, not necessarily doing it to give to receive, but ultimately it's good from just a reputational point of view and being known and being trusted and as a good citizen, you know, ultimately good things happen from doing good things. Talking of exciting and good things, this year's another big year for you because you have a book coming out and you alluded to the sort of comment earlier, Protect Your Neck. So tell us yes. A bit about what your book is all about and what they can expect.
Well, the book is it is called Protect Your Neck, and it's the keys to maximizing your car accident settlement. Every one of my clients is going to receive a copy of this book for free.
I think it's an amalgamation of a lot of frequently asked questions and frequently given advice that my firm provides to our clients. And so it was like, at one point I just said, man, I should just sit down and write all this out. And then I don't have to give it in the same phone call methods over and over again. I still think I'm going to end up giving it on a regular basis. But I think that if people have a way, if they're interested, if they have a way to read this book, there's going to be 12 chapters. It's not going to be a small book, but 12 chapters of just what does it mean to keep your social media private, and stories and anecdotal evidence of how that has negatively impacted other people's claims in a very significant way. Understanding that the insurance company is able to get every time you've punched into your gym, they can subpoena the gym to give all of your swipe ins. And if you're saying you're injured, but then they see on video you bench pressing 250 pounds, that video is going to come up. And that video is going to be used as evidence against you. So understanding what tools the insurance company has to minimize your claims so that you can be proactive before those are issues, I think is an incredibly important part of the process. And so educating my clients, if I could spend, you know, hours at a time over and over and over just saying, hey, don't do this, please do that. Don't do this, please do that. I would, but at this point we have a lot of clients, and the time to give that one-on-one with just me and them is very limited. And so I wanted to still be a resource in a way that I could be robust with what I'm describing to them. And this book is my method for doing that, but it's completely available to the public. It's free for any of my clients, but it would absolutely benefit anyone going through a car accident in any state.
Yeah, and absolutely. And we would definitely encourage people to go and check it out for sure in due course. Okay, I want to also talk about podcasting, because you don't just stop at being an author, you know, running a firm. You've also got your own podcast, the Iron Mind podcast. So what are some of the topics you've discussed, and who is your dream guest?
Well, some of the topics that we've discussed are things that I've talked about so far on the show here today: Winter's fees, Mahler fees, those very complicated calculations that people who are just dipping their toes in personal injury might not even know exist. And so understanding that these things are a part of negotiating these claims, and how to calculate these fees in a way that there isn't a lot of resources on the internet for Washington specific, personal injury specific, methods for calculating these fees. So I try to think about the things as a young lawyer that I had to go seek out and learn, and provide all of those resources in one specific way without it being taught specifically by me. So I have a guest on every episode. The guest is someone who I found valuable in my career. And I say, explain to us in gory detail how X, Y, and Z works. So it's really personal injury focused and entrepreneurship focused. So if you're a personal injury attorney, you're going to see incredible value in it. If you run your own firm, you're going to see incredible value in it. And if you're a personal injury attorney in Washington who runs your own firm, it's going to be top tier for you. There's not going to be another podcast like it. So I really encourage anyone who's like me, who started their own firm, who does personal injury work, to really give it a listen. Every episode has value, and I really love it. But the second question that you had was, who's my dream guest? And it's kind of a joke, but we've attempted to get a lot of celebrities. I think it's cool that you had Carol Baskin on yours. The most recent guest that turned us down politely was Bill Nye, the science guy from Seattle. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's a local hometown hero, and I would love to have him on the show to talk about his engineering background and the science behind car accidents or plane accidents, and the things that he might know about from his experience working at Boeing and all these other cool places. But I've also tried to get some famous celebrity comedians and things like that, just people that might have been in car accidents, to talk about their experiences.
Tracy Morgan is a really famous comedian, and tried really hard to contact him, but kind of out of the budget for the first season here. Maybe we'll see how we're doing in a couple months, couple years, and see if we got a budget for Tracy.
Absolutely. Well, Tracy, Bill, all of the big stars, if you are listening, which I'm sure you hopefully are, make sure you get in touch with Josh and his team, because I think they'll make for awesome episodes, and there's real value in those shows. Okay, so we've talked about, obviously, your authoring work, talked about your podcasting work. Let's talk about social media, because you can't avoid it. You know, you need to be there in 2024, that's for sure. So you're pretty active on LinkedIn, Instagram, X, Facebook, etc. How do you utilize social media platforms to build your personal brand alongside educating and informing your followers?
Well, I think it's important for social media to not be a carbon copy of every other lawyer's social media. So that's an incredibly difficult thing to do. But I don't know anyone who hired an attorney because they made a Happy Father's Day post on social media. So I'm not incredibly tied to those types of, hey, it's a U.S. holiday, Happy Groundhog's Day, everyone, or whatever. I think that's a cop out for a social media manager to have something to post because they aren't creative. And I try very hard to work with my social media team to have creative posts. And that's super difficult because it's very easy to just put out content, but content that's engaging is difficult. And that's what people seek out: content that's engaging, content that they can learn from, content that has value. And so putting things in the ether that say, happy birthday to our paralegal, while it's important for that paralegal to feel valued, that paralegal might not even have social media and never see the post. So then you've got a whole bunch of content: happy Groundhog's Day, happy birthday to our receptionist, happy anniversary to one of our attorneys, with zero engagement. And that actually has a negative impact on your reputation on social media. So I refuse to make those kinds of posts, because I don't want my social media to be seen by someone who's vetting my business as something that has no engagement. So our staff, the staff that is involved with social media, they're tagged in every one of our posts so that their personal Instagram, they're sharing it. And that engagement really helps us to grow our reach. And I am disheartened on a regular basis when I follow a new law firm and I say, wow, these are beautifully curated posts, beautiful pictures, great graphics, good articulate captions, and two likes, and they're probably both people on the social media team. And that's just, it's so cringy, and I hate to see it, and I never want my content to be viewed that way. So I try really hard to think of creative skits or creative posts that are just different than Happy Groundhog's Day.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, you're right. You know, we've had a whole host of guests come on the show, and we've had some of the, you know, we've always had like Bill Moore, the meme lord on the show. And, you know, he talks about sort of the creative posts and the art of the creator, you know, in terms of getting your message across that's engaging and educational, and, you know, builds a good brand. And you're right, there's no point just copying what's already out there. You want to be original, you want to share your wisdom, but you want to do it in a creative way. And like you say, that takes work. So it's great that you're looking at that way, and it's great that you're giving value to people in your community. So this has been a masterclass start to finish, as I always knew it was going to be, Josh. What would be, before we look to wrap up, your sort of final piece of advice for any aspiring lawyers want to pursue a career in personal injury law?
So I think that making sure that you have a mentor is incredibly important. Understanding that, you know, anyone can learn what they're doing wrong, and you don't know if you're not asking questions. So find an attorney who knows more than you do about an area that you're interested in practicing with, and work directly with them, learn from them, work on cases with them, donate your time to them. I'm going to give a shout out to some of the attorneys that I work with. Igor Shapiro, if you're listening to this, thank you for everything that we've worked on together. Talwinder Singh, Jashan Multani, Nicole Fisher, all these attorneys that I've worked with, Cole Douglas. I could go on and on and on, but we're a network of attorneys that all have the same goal, and that's to maximize the value of these clients' claims and do what we can to take the money from the insurance companies and give it to our clients. So if you're listening to this and you're a new attorney, go out, find someone who knows how to do what you're interested in doing and knows how to do it better than you, a mentor, an idol, and find out what they're doing. Learn their tricks of the trade. They want to teach those things to you. They want you to emulate them and then eventually add value to what they're doing that you might see from the outside. And so everybody wins when we're doing that. There's a huge population of personal injury attorneys in Washington, but the more we work together, the better we all do. So understanding that it's about collaboration, not competition.
Yeah, I say it like a broken record. Collaboration is domination and we is greater than me. It's so true. Right. This has been fantastic, Josh. It has to be said. Where can our listeners go on to learn more about your career journey, your firm? Where are the best places for them to go and find your podcast? Feel free to shout out any website links, social media handles. We'll also share them with this episode for you too.
Yeah, brumleylawfirm.com is the website, at Brumley Law Firm, at ironmind.podcast on Instagram and social media. Ironmindpodcast.com for the people interested in that. You can listen to the podcast on YouTube and Spotify and all the major podcast channels. So give it a shout, give it a listen. I'm super approachable. If you direct message any of the social media channels, you're going to get through right to me. So if you have questions or want to learn more about the personal injury process in Washington, hit me up.
There you have it, folks. As I say, Josh, I've really, really enjoyed today. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Wishing you lots of continued success with your firm, career, and wider pursuits and all the good work you're doing for the communities. But now, from all of us on the Legal Speaking Podcast, over and out. Thank you for listening to this week's episode. If you like the content here, why not check out our world-leading content and collaboration hub, the Legally Speaking Club, over on Discord. Go to our website, www.legallyspeakingpodcast.com, for the link to join our community there. Over and out.